This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert's out today. A recent study shows nearly 40% of news stories on mental illness link mental health problems to violent behavior, even though less than 5% of violence in the U.S. is linked to mental health issues. That comes from a study by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, which looked at news reports on violence over a 20-year period. Assistant Professor Beth McGinty worked on the report. She joins us now. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the media side of your study and what maybe the media is getting wrong about linking mental illness and violence, let's talk about maybe the right way to think about it. How should we think about the connection or maybe lack of connection between mental health problems and violence?
Well, the research evidence shows that most people with serious mental illness, which is a category that includes conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, are never violent toward other people. There is, in a small number of cases, an elevated risk of violence associated with psychotic symptoms like hallucinations or delusions, but that's very much the minority. Most people with mental illness will never be violent toward other people. And what's more, the research evidence clearly shows that most interpersonal violence, violence directed at other people in the United States, is not caused by mental illness. Only about 3 to 5% of all violence in our nation has an underlying cause related to mental illness.
So if I can say that back to you, people with mental illness, with diagnosable mental illness, generally don't represent any greater threat of violence, and most violence is not connected to a diagnosable mental illness.
That's correct.
Well, now let's turn to the media now. That was the focus of this study. You looked at media coverage of violence and of mental illness. What kind of things did you find when it came to connecting those two?
So what we did is look at news coverage in a sample of high circulation and high viewership newspapers and television transcripts over the past two decades, 1995 to 2014. And we looked at news stories that were focused on mental illness and then examined the content of those news stories and how it changed or did not change over time. And what we found was that there were very few changes in news media coverage of mental illness over that period, and that a large segment, about 40% of all news coverage about mental illness, linked mental illness with interpersonal violence, which is disproportionate to the actual research evidence-based link that I just described.
So what kind of reporting would that look like? I assume it has to do with crime reporting. I would think of mass shooting situations. Are those the kind of stories where that link was often made?
Yes, that's correct. We saw in the second decade of the study an increase in the proportion of stories that linked mental illness with mass shootings specifically, which probably resonates with listeners as we've had a series of high-profile mass shootings over that time period, some of which had a documented mental illness involved.
And the assumption, I think, from people is often that to commit a mass shooting, there must be something wrong with that person. There must be something mentally wrong with that person. But from the standpoint of diagnosing mental illnesses, that's not necessarily true, right?
That's correct. So I think it's clear that anyone who commits violence towards another person, a mass shooting or any other type of violence, is not what anyone would consider mentally well. But that does not necessarily mean that they have a diagnosable and treatable mental illness. The issue could have to do with emotional regulation or anger or a whole host of other risk factors for interpersonal violence, like substance use or a history of abuse or trauma in their life that are the causal factor driving that violence.
As I understand it, on the flip side, your research found not only this negative connection, this connection between mental illness and violence being made in media reports, but a lack of positive coverage, of talking about, say, people with mental illnesses living positive everyday lives or of successful treatment. Is that right?
That's right. So while we know that these news media portrayals of mental illness and violence are stigmatizing, they cause readers and viewers to increase social stigma towards people with mental illness, positive portrayals of successful treatment and recovery do not increase stigma, and by some measures actually decrease stigma. And so ideally, we would like to see more of those positive portrayals, but we only saw them in about 14% of news stories about mental illness.
We're talking to Beth McGinty from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health about new research on media coverage of issues of mental illness and of violence. The finding: media connect mental illness and violence way more than they're connected in reality. You just mentioned, Beth, stigma. How important a part of that of the story is that?
This is a very important part of the story. So we know, we have good experimental research showing that exposure to news stories about mental illness and violence, especially very serious, high-profile acts of violence like mass shootings, increases social stigma towards people with serious mental illness. It increases the misperception that people are likely to be dangerous, which in turn increases fear toward people with mental illness and leads to unwillingness to work with people with mental illness or live near people with mental illness. And that stigma has really negative effects on those with serious mental illness themselves. It can lead to unwillingness to seek treatment because they don't want to disclose their condition. It can lead to discrimination in housing and employment, which contributes to high rates of unemployment and homelessness, as well as criminal justice involvement in this population.
So it ultimately, the stigma conveyed by these news stories makes it worse, the condition worse for someone dealing with a mental illness, it sounds like.
Yes, that's correct.
So I know you're not in the newsrooms, but if you were, what kind of things would you tell producers or suggest to producers that they do to round out their coverage, to portray more sides, more positive sides, more realistic sides of the story of mental illness?
Well, I think there are several improvements that can be made. One is to not assume or speculate about a role of mental illness in interpersonal violence unless it's actually documented. So in the mass shooting example, in some of the recent mass shootings that we've had, serious mental illness played a documented role. For example, the Tucson shooting where Gabrielle Giffords was wounded. The perpetrator of that shooting was subsequently diagnosed with schizophrenia. So in that scenario, I don't think there's any expectation that reporters fail to accurately report that fact. However, what we've seen is that there's often an assumption that serious mental illness must have been involved, even in the absence of that sort of documentation. And so I think step number one is sort of avoiding that kind of speculative link, which, you know, links mental illness and violence in the eyes of audiences, even though it hasn't been documented as fact. The other piece, I think, is really trying to balance coverage of mental illness and violence with coverage of successful treatment and recovery. We are in an era of a lot of advances in treatment and other evidence-based services like supported employment and housing for people with mental illness that really work very well, and there are lots of success stories out there. Given that those kinds of stories we know don't have the negative effects on stigma and can't even reduce stigma, we really need a shift toward those topics.
Beth, thanks so much for sharing this research with us.
Thank you.
That was Beth McGinty from Johns Hopkins University. It's taken Hope Jaron years to see the plants of the world as the complex living things that they are. Now she's hoping her book helps the rest of the world see them that way. In her new memoir, Lab Girl, Jaron tells the story of her lifelong fascination with science and plants and what it's like working as a woman in science. Veronica Rickard talked to her yesterday in our studios.
Hope, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, you write about your lab in a way that I've never heard anybody write about a lab before, a way I haven't even really considered what a lab could be other than a place where science is done. In your own words, what is a lab to you?
Well, it's home. You know, I mean, I have a place where I sleep, but I have this place where I work and dream and play with my best friend and make stuff and figure stuff out and break stuff and fix it and mess up and come through. You know, the big moments of my life professionally, and a lot of the personal ones all took place in a lab. The lab has moved around to different locations, but a lot of the stuff in it is the original stuff that I've always had. And a lot of labs, you know, they're the same at heart. They've got the same, you know, collection of beakers, you know, sort of like your kitchen. Every kitchen has measuring cups and things like that. There's a collection of stuff that was always there. And of course, those things remind me of my father's lab. And it's this place that's always been in my life. And I can't imagine not having a lab to go to. I mean, I sit around, I talk about it. And I start looking at this studio and thinking, why am I here? You know, I have a lab somewhere I could be in. What is wrong with this day that I'm not in my favorite place? But I'm glad to be here talking to you.
And you said your father was a scientist and you hung out with him in the lab ever since you were small. Some of your earliest memories sounds like you remember playing beneath the bench in his lab. So you obviously connected with that. But when did you realize that this was a deeper connection that was also science, and this is what you wanted to do with the rest of your life?
Well, I never did realize it, because in fact my earliest memories were in the lab. My father was a community college teacher. He taught at the same place for 42 years, and he taught all the sciences. He taught in rural Minnesota. It was the only higher education institution in the county. And he wasn't just a scientist. He was the scientist, you know, in the county. And he taught, you know, physics was his great love, and he taught earth science and chemistry in the engineering courses, and he had demonstrations and lab benches, and all the students had their stuff. And somebody in my family was always working. And so after dinner, he had papers to grade and he had to set up for the next day. And me and my brothers went with him, and we learned how to fix the stuff and maintain it and pull it out and go through the next day's exercise. And my very earliest memories were doing that with him. He loved the place and we loved being there, and he let us have full run of the place. And so I always thought, well, when I grow up, I'll have a lab and we'll do this and that. And I thought that's what just people did, you know?
They grew up and had labs.
And it wasn't until later that people asked me how I decided to become a scientist, or how I would. And I never did decide it. I think I was the same scientist in a very important way then that I am now, which is why the book is called Lab Girl, because I was a girl in the lab. I was the lab girl. And, you know, that is what I still am at my core. That's what I still am.
And it ended up that your specialty, the thing that really held you spellbound, was plants. You study soil chemistry, biochemistry. You do work with isotopes, trying to figure out what the lives of plants were like way before we were around. What is it about plants in particular that you love?
It was sort of the hardest problem I could come up with. You know, it was sort of the biggest challenge I could set for myself. My dad loved rocks, and we would drive, you know, in the summer. You know, teachers have the summer quote unquote off, right? And in the summer we would drive, you know, hundreds of miles to see this rock that he'd read about, this outcrop or whatever. And so I always loved rocks. And I was studying rocks, and I was studying rocks that are made inside plants because they turn up as fossils. And just like, you know, you, not exactly like, but your teeth are actually made out of rock. They're made out of mineral. So there's a lot of organisms that precipitate minerals as part of their biological functioning. And plants do that too. You know, a peach pit is an example of that. So for my dissertation, I was studying a mineral that's precipitated inside hackberry seeds, which is a little tree that's kind of ordinary, but it's everywhere. And I set up these experiments where I was watching these trees all summer, and I was recording different attributes of them. And then at the end, the grand finale was I was going to collect these fruits and analyze the minerals inside. Well, we got to the end of the summer, and none of the trees, I had trees in South Dakota and Nebraska, and none of the trees bore fruit that year. And nobody could tell me why. And the local landowners said, yeah, this sometimes happens, but there wasn't anything obvious correlated with the weather or whatever it was. And it just became very, very clear to me during that time that these things weren't there in order to produce materials that I could use in my thesis. They were doing their own thing for their own reasons. And that was my first glimmer into the fact that understanding how these things are alive. I mean, I knew plants were alive in a way that rocks weren't, but the depth of how much they were alive and how inscrutable that would be, and how figuring out even just a little corner of how they worked and what they were trying to do by being alive, I knew that was going to be one of the biggest challenge I could come up with and the great problem of my life, it turns out.
And you also, you give the reader a glimpse into what it's like to see the world, to see plants through your eyes and seeds. I'm now seeing in completely different ways, thanks to the way that you write about them.
And that was the only thing that helped, you know, is to think, you know, guess what? This tree wasn't, it wasn't having my summer. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to make the fruits and we're going to write a thesis and da da da. It was doing its own thing for its own reasons. And so only when I started to look at the world, like, what, why does it? What's it trying to do when it makes a seed? What's it trying to accomplish with this mineral? That's the only way I ever got closer to getting some insight in the problem. And so I began to think that way and think that way at every turn. And that was kind of my go-to. And there's things that I've learned from walking around the world that way. And I wanted to share it. And I did my best to put that in language that could be shared. And it's a great, great joy to see that people think that was something worth sharing.
We're talking with Hope Jaron right now. She is a biochemist, studies plants, as we're talking about. And her new book is called Lab Girl. It's a story of her life and science. And Hope, one thing you invite the reader to do early on is to look out the window. Look past all the human-made buildings that are out there and see all the green stuff, the trees, and to see things differently. I mean, when you see the world now, because you've said that you're only really, you know, some decades into your career starting to see plants really for what they are. How do you see them now when you look out and see a tree?
Well, the more you see them, the less you see yourself, I think. You know, we live, compared to our grandparents. One thing I do in the classroom is I say, how many people grew up on a farm? And then I say, raise your hand if your parents grew up on a farm. And then I say, raise your hand if your grandparents grew up on a farm. And then a generation back. And you start out with almost no hands up, and you end up with most of the hands in the classroom up. And this varies from room to room. But what we've done in these course of generations is we've really gotten away from the land. We've gotten away from the way we used to live, which was to really worry about how the world was greening up each year and noticing, you know, every leaf that grew because, you know, that was coming to somebody's supper table or to somebody's bank account. And now we live in very urban spaces. We live in social spaces where plants don't seem to matter. And yet, if you look around and see how much around you is made out of wood, or if you consider a lot of the medicines that we use, and of course all the food that we eat is based on plant productivity, you see that we are living with it. We've just removed it in our experience. And so I start out the book by saying, let's get back to that. And it's easy. Just notice it. Just notice it with me. And I've seen how that can enrich people's lives. You know, that's a lot of what I do in the classroom is encourage students to say, well, actually, when you go outside, there's way more green stuff than there is animal stuff or even built stuff. You know, if you just see the green, you start to think about how terribly outmassed we are by all this photosynthetic tissue. And then we can start to think about how it's their world and how that operates. And so I see it as a way to transcend myself and in some ways transcend all these kind of miserable social problems that we have and that our parents had and that don't seem to be going anywhere. And I think it's a great opportunity to focus on something that's bigger than ourselves and an organism that in some weird way has it all figured out. You know, has been here 400 million years without wrecking everything. and that's one of the reasons I like it.
Well, switching gears now, along with the science, your book is also about being an academic and to a certain extent being a woman in science. And I want to read a line from your book. You write that sexism is simply the cumulative weight of constantly being told that you can't possibly be who you are. How did that play out in your career?
Well, I mean, I've had rough things happen to me. And I, you know, I wasn't raised to expect life to be pleasant or comfortable. So I wasn't particularly surprised when it turned out not to be. But I think what grinds on you is really those constant moments of being introduced as the professor and seeing that light in somebody's eyes that says, whoa, there's a mistake here. Her? You know, that can't be right. And I get to the point where I actively avoid telling people that I'm an academic or that I'm a scientist or whatever, because I hate that moment. I hate that moment of you, that couldn't be you. And so it's not a shame thing, but I'm tired of the world taking the most precious thing I am and just refusing to believe it every hour of every day. You know, that doesn't sound like a super huge hardship, but that's the part that grinds on you. And in a way, that's what makes the lab all the more special, is I go in there and I close the door and there's a limited number of people in there and we are what we are. And it doesn't matter whether whoever is outside that door is incredulous about it. All that matters is what we might get done before we have to leave today.
Hope, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Hope Jaron is a geobiologist and geochemist at the University of Hawaii. She's been named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. She's the author of the book Lab Girl. She spoke with Veronica Rickert in our studio yesterday. It's been a few years since Wisconsin saw its last heat wave. In the summer of 2012, record heat levels hit the Midwest, and we could be seeing temperatures in the 90s as early as tomorrow with some heat advisories out there. Governor Walker declared today Heat Awareness Day, since heat can have serious health repercussions. Joining me now to talk more about how you and your community can stay safe and cool this summer is Alicia Parma. She's a family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health. She specializes in family medicine and urgent care at the Prevea Kewaunee Health Center. Alicia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to some specific tips, I think a lot of people, when they think of getting ready for weather emergencies, they're thinking blizzards or tornadoes or thunderstorms, things like that. Should we be taking heat more seriously than maybe we usually do?
Absolutely. Heat can affect a wide range of people, and it can lead to some pretty severe consequences if not taken care of in an appropriate way.
What are some of the basic preventive things that you want people to know when temperatures start to get into the 90s and that heat index even higher?
Some things that you can do to help prevent any sorts of heat-related illness would be to make sure that you're staying hydrated. You want to make sure that you're drinking a lot of water. On an average day, an adult is supposed to drink 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day. So you definitely want to increase that when the temperatures start to increase. If you plan to do any working outdoors or exercising heavily, you should increase that amount to 2 to 4 glasses of water every hour while you're engaging in that activity.
Who are some of the people most at risk of problems with heat?
When we think about that, we look at adults and over the age of 65. They are affected by the heat much more rapidly, and particularly we're looking at those who live alone or have infrequent contact with family or friends. Infants and children can also be at risk. They aren't old enough to care for themselves and are often dependent on others and have difficulty telling others how they are feeling. And then a third group that we also look at are those who are overweight or have chronic medical conditions. They can be affected by the heat rapidly as well and can be taking medications that can also contribute to not processing the heat the same way.
A really basic warning, I think the word is mostly out there, but those categories of people in particular shouldn't be left alone in cars in this kind of hot weather.
Correct. You should never leave any children, infants, or pets in a hot car, even if the windows are rolled down.
Now, part of this is a social concern. You mentioned people who live alone. Do you encourage people to check in on people who live alone, especially people in those at-risk categories?
Absolutely. The recommendation would be to check in with them at least twice a day to make sure that they are still feeling well and keeping hydrated.
We're talking to Alicia Parma, family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health in Kewaunee. You can join in as we talk about heat. It's getting warm tomorrow. It is Heat Awareness Day today. What do you do? Do you keep in touch with people? Have you encountered problems? Are you on a work site where you're paying attention to this issue? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alicia, what are the warning signs that someone is having trouble dealing with the heat, having a health problem related to hot weather?
When we look at somebody who is experiencing signs and symptoms of heat stroke, we actually will start to observe an elevated high body temperature of 103 degrees or higher. It can actually reach 106 degrees within 10 to 15 minutes. They also will have red, hot, dry skin and a lack of sweating, a rapid, strong heartbeat, a throbbing headache, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, confusion, and a decreased level of consciousness.
So is this an urgent care situation or even an emergency room situation?
If you are noticing those symptoms and you're concerned of heat stroke, this is an emergency room type situation.
What kind of warning signs would we watch for? Hopefully we don't have it go that far. What are some of the other things that might tip us off that, hey, we're having trouble with the heat, we need to do something about this?
Yep, we can see somebody who may be experiencing heat cramps. This is typically a very early sign to note if someone's being affected by the heat. Those would be muscle spasms that can occur usually in the abdomen, the arms, the legs, a lot of times associated with somebody who is participating in strenuous activity in the heat, and an early warning sign of heat exhaustion, which is a milder form of heat-related illness, but still something that should be taken seriously. And in those individuals, we'll see heavy sweating, paleness, the cramps that I just discussed, tiredness, weakness, dizziness, headaches, nausea, vomiting, fainting.
So if I'm feeling these symptoms or I see someone else who seems to be exhibiting those signs, what should we do?
We should take that individual to a cool, shaded area, offer them cool, non-alcoholic beverages, let them rest, try and cool them off with water using towels or anything you may have available. If you can bring them to an air-conditioned environment, that's better even than a cool, shaded area.
Do you see a lot of people in the course of a hot summer showing up at your clinic with these kind of problems?
We haven't seen any so far yet. Kewaunee is right on Lake Michigan, so we often don't have that problem. But with the warmer temperatures coming over the weekend, it is definitely a possibility.
And for parents, what kind of advice do you have for them in dealing with their kids?
I would recommend that if you can, to stay inside, particularly in the afternoon hours, would be ideal, getting them to an air-conditioned place. And if you don't have air conditioning at home, other options would include going to a shopping mall, a public library, a theater, or checking your area for any local cooling shelters that are available. If you must be outside, make sure that you're doing everything you can to protect yourself from the sun in terms of sunscreen, lightweight clothing, and head and eye protection.
Is this something you think a lot of people maybe ignore, the early warning signs, either choosing to tough it out or not really even thinking that heat's going to be a problem for them?
I do. I think that when you think of heat-related illness, you do think of those high-risk groups, and you don't believe that you fall into one of those. But if you continue to work or exercise aggressively in the heat, you can become affected by this just the same.
We're talking to Alicia Parma. She's a family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health in Kewaunee, talking about what we can do to stay safe and healthy during extra high temperatures in Wisconsin. Today is Heat Awareness Day, and just in time. We're seeing temperatures going up into the 90s in parts of the state. Some heat advisories in a lot of southern Wisconsin coming up tomorrow and Saturday. We want to hear from you. Do you have a tip on staying cool in the summer? Do you check up on family members, neighbors, elderly community members? Do you provide a cooling station in your community? Are you involved in public service like this? And if you work in healthcare, do you see this on these hot days in Wisconsin? Not like today, but maybe like the next couple. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page where we have a list of cooling centers around the state available. And maybe you spend time outdoors for work and you have questions for Alicia. You can call in now, 800-642-1234. I'm continuing the conversation now with Alicia Parma, family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health in Kewaunee. Today is Heat Awareness Day here in Wisconsin, announced by the governor, in an effort to draw attention to health hazards related to hot weather. And over the next couple of days, there's some high temperatures, high humidity in the 90s, actually, as early as tomorrow, and some related heat advisories out there in parts of the state. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On a serious note, what have you done to deal with heat and heat waves in the past? Are you from a warmer part of the country? Do you have some advice to share from us? On a lighter note, what do you like to do on hot days to cool off? How do you like to beat the heat, whether that's taking in that air-conditioned movie, getting out in a pool? I don't know, maybe a water park? Serious or fun, we want to hear how you deal with hot weather or your questions on the health impacts of severe heat. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page where we've got a link to cooling stations around the state. Alicia, can you talk more about seniors? Why are they more vulnerable in particular to heat?
We look at older adults. Simply, they do not adjust as well to the temperatures as people who are of younger age. But they're also more likely to have chronic medical conditions that can change their normal response to heat. And again, in going along with that, they also will take prescription medications that can impair their body's ability to regulate the temperature or can inhibit perspiration.
We had a question from Denise in Dodgeville who called, couldn't stay on the line. She wonders, when the weather is hot, are fans really helpful? It seems like they just circulate the hot air. Is that part of the advice for people maybe feeling those early warning signs of heat? Are fans helpful?
Fans can help provide some comfort, but if the temperatures are getting into the high 90s, they are not going to prevent heat-related illness. Really, the best possible way is to find some sort of air-conditioned place to spend some time in. Even a few hours will go a long way in helping your body stay cooler.
People are also thinking about pets this time of year and the heat. Teresa on Facebook writes, if anybody has pocket pets, little guys, she says, freeze pop bottles or juice bottles and put them in a sock or wrap them in a towel before sticking it in the cage. But they'd appreciate that. And I wonder, do you have advice on keep? I know you deal mostly with humans, Alicia, but do you have advice on pet safety as well?
I think, again, we need to think about their hydration level, too, and make sure that they always have fresh water available to them throughout the day, particularly in the afternoon hours when it's even hotter.
So people being affected by heat-related illnesses, maybe, as we were saying earlier, don't take it seriously enough. I mean, what are potential long-term risks, short-term risks, for that matter, if we ignore these problems?
Some of the things that you can look at with heat stroke could be a long-term disability. The most severe, of course, would be death in terms of heat stroke.
Talking to Alicia Parma, family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health. She specializes in family medicine and urgent care at the Prevea Kewaunee Health Center in Kewaunee, talking about Heat Awareness Day, a warning to be aware of the possible health impacts of high heat. and to take precautions. We've got some hot weather coming up. You can still call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you like to beat the heat? Have you had this problem, maybe at work or at a festival or something like that? How did you come through it? If you're a healthcare provider, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or head over to the Central Time Facebook page. And do you, Alicia, for some people, maybe recommend, if at all possible, avoiding that work outside or exercising outside when it gets really hot?
Definitely. If that's a possibility, that would be the primary recommendation. However, if you're in an area that is experiencing an early heat wave early in the season, you can also limit your activity and work your way back up to the exercise or the work that you're used to doing in order to give your body a chance to adjust.
And do you advise managers, foremen of work crews, to maybe lighten the workload on really hot days?
I think if that's at all possible, that would be a great idea. However, I know that summertime is prime hours for construction as well.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is on the line in La Crosse. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I go to a lot of music festivals and such during the summer and end up camping in a lot of open fields on the hills, and there really isn't a whole lot of shade. I was just wondering if you had any tips to be able to, other than just stay hydrated, I guess.
Jake, thanks for that call. Stay hydrated, definitely. Alicia, any other advice?
I think a good thing to remember, particularly with going to music festivals, is to really limit the amount of alcohol that you're intaking. That can actually cause you to lose more fluids rather than drinking water. Also, if you can spend some time immersed in water, like a pool, or taking a cool shower, that will also help keep your core temperature lower.
Jake, good luck. Thanks a lot for that call. And I know with beer festivals in Wisconsin, too, on those hot days, they often recommend a couple cups of water between each beer.
Absolutely.
Jake, thanks for the call. We've got Ben on the line in Osceola. Ben, hi.
Hi. When it's hot like this, I like to soak my shirt and wring it out. That really keeps you cool.
And then put it back on wet.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Great idea, Ben. People get really creative, don't they, Alicia?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and I've done the trick where you soak a rag, put it in the freezer for a while, and just wear it as like a little scarf. That can be pretty handy, too.
Yes, absolutely. Any way to possibly just keep your body temperature down is a good idea.
Well, Alicia, can you leave us with some words of advice, a warning to take heat seriously out there in Wisconsin as it heats up over the next couple of days?
I think it's really important just to stay informed. Keep an eye on local news, weather channels. Make sure that you know what the temperature is going to be, but also the heat index for the day, and plan ahead for those activities in the next few days, and try and spend more time indoors if at all possible. But then also, too, if you do need to go outside or you're going to be spending time, just make sure that you're smart about it, that you are protecting yourself from the sun with sunscreen, lightweight clothing, head and eye protection.
Alicia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alicia Parma. She's a family nurse practitioner at Prevea Health. She specializes in family medicine and urgent care at the Prevea Kewaunee Health Center in Kewaunee, giving us some advice to deal with heat this summer on Heat Awareness Day. Warm temperatures over the 90s in a lot of places coming up over the next couple of days. Share your ways to beat the heat on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can find cooling stations in your community.